Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll put context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Duduzile Ramela. Here's what you can look forward to. Fuel fears threaten South Africa's citrus export season. We'll speak to the Citrus Growers Association. We take a look at the best case and the worst case scenarios for the next 6 to 12 months and what South Africans should watch out for in light of great geopolitical tensions. We also speak to Statistics South Africa about the country's child poverty crisis, which is deepening. Thandanani Mbele is with PPS Short-Term Insurance, and he talks to us about water cuts mirroring load shedding and the economic toll it could take. We also take a look at South Africa's brand value. It's soaring as banking, retail and telecoms dominate. As South Africa's citrus export season begins, growers are sounding the alarm about isolated cases of diesel shortages, seemingly caused by unusual buying patterns and controlled allocation by industry players. This in spite of the Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources saying the country's fuel supply remains stable for the near term. 95% of citrus exports are moved by road to ports, exposing the industry to fuel supply and price shocks. Dr. Toko Nchabele is CEO of the Citrus Growers Association. He joins us now to explore available options to cushion the potential blow caused by hoarding. Thank you very much, Doc, for your time. What is the situation as we speak today?
So we still are concerned in terms of the reports that we are receiving that there's isolated incidences of or diesel shortages, in several areas. But we haven't had the updated information as of today, but as of yesterday, that was still the information that we had at hand.
We also know that the petrol price from today is gone up 3 rand, a fuel levy cut. Does that make a difference at all? As you mentioned, you move your goods by road to port, so that consumes a lot of fuel.
We are concerned, although we welcome the 3 rand reprieve, we believe that more can still be done. I think one of the challenges that, and this is what we supported, raised by AgriSA and AgBiz, what can ultimately impact the hoarding and so forth would be improved transparency in terms of fuel pricing. And that can also be driven through, call it weekly adjustments in terms of the regulated prices of fuel. You know that currently we all had to wait for today. Mm. And because of that, that could have influenced all the behavioral issues that have been mentioned, rationing and controlling fuel. Because ultimately, with the expected increase, there is a likelihood for some profit to be made simply selling at a higher price next week. So if the price is adjusted continuously, the market, that information flows to everyone, that improves transparency.
South Africa exported a record of 3.5 million metric tons of citrus in 2025, and we are the world's second largest citrus exporter after Spain. As we speak about energy prices, this is as a result of what is happening in the Middle East. I do wonder how this has impacted, or if it has an impact at all on your supply chains. If so, how?
So our season hasn't started as yet, and one of the reasons we're sounding alarm bells is that we're trying to look forward and say, you know, as we look at the horizon, this is one of the key issues that might have an impact on our season. And this is because, as we say, 95% of our shipments are on road, and we support the initiatives that have come out of the Department of Transport trying to move a lot of consignments that are on the road to rail. We know that will take some time, but that would give us some sort of breathing space, because rail is cheaper and it's much more dependable, and ultimately it will help us to get to market much more quicker than we currently are experiencing with road. But ultimately, with all these price increases, we run the risk of growers making losses, as they would be impacted by high fuel prices. I mean, fuel is used also on farms to do many other things, to water orchards. It's also used to move tractors and so forth as fruit is collected from the orchards to pack houses. So it's quite a significant cost for citrus growers.
In spite of the DMPR warning, not even warning, or rather just stating, listen, fuel supply remains stable for the near term. There's been hoarding that has been experienced, which is something that is of concern to you, of course, as an organization, but to the sector at large. What are the contingency plans that you have in place? If you do not have contingency plans, what then is your call more so to South Africans?
I think if we all as South Africans become more responsible and there is better coordination between government and all other players, that would help us to and assist the situation to reduce all the other behaviors that we've spoken to. And ultimately, all of us will benefit, and there's a greater public good that can be achieved for all citizens as well as our growers.
On a lighter note, we've been having amazing rain. What has this done for the crop?
So we've had in many areas of the country, we've had very good growing conditions, and we're looking forward with huge expectations that we might have a good crop. Sometime in the week we will release our own estimates as to what that looks like. But on the whole, in a rounded way, we potentially have a good crop coming out.
Might exceed last year's record of 3.5 million metric tons of citrus.
That remains to be seen, because ultimately the estimate that we normally offer is not a production estimate per se. It is what is possible to be exported, and so we call it an export estimate. And to give you a sense, with the current impact in the Middle East, where we send 20-25% of our crop, ultimately you start having to look at that crop and say, are we to adjust estimates differently? In view of the unlikely event we can't send the crop to some parts of the world. So those are the likely other impacts at play that would impact our ability to give a higher or a lower estimate.
You mentioned a very good point because the Middle East is the second biggest export market for South African citrus after Europe, and last year it accounted for 19% of total shipments. Are you able to give us more detail in terms of the outlook? Because in the short term, we're hearing that this will be wrapped up in about 2 to 3 weeks' time. We're also expecting another address tonight from the President of the United States. We're not clear what's going to come out of that. Even though the markets are rallying, there's still some cautious optimism. On your side, what does it look like?
Look, we're keenly watching the situation as it evolves, and we are cautiously optimistic that some sort of opportunity is available and on the table for the parties to resolve the dispute. And that would give us opportunities to be able to ship the usual shipments that go to that part of the world. Our season starts in a few weeks, and we are hopeful that some sort of leeway is on the table to make that a reality.
Thank you so much for your contribution, Doc. Dr. Buitoko Ntshabele, CEO of Citrus Growers Association.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
As global tensions continue to rise from the conflict in the Middle East to ongoing pressures on key trade routes, the ripple effects are being felt far beyond the front lines. For South Africans, it's showing up where it matters most, at the fuel pump and food prices and in the broader cost of living. But what happens next? Are we heading toward relief or more pressure in the months ahead? To help us unpack this and look at the worst case scenarios for the next 6 to 12 months and what South Africans should be watching out for, we're joined by Dr. Elizabeth Stevens, Director at Geopolitical Risk Advisory. Thank you very much, Doc, for your time. Maybe let's start with what we heard from the President of the United States yesterday, Donald Trump, indicating that there might be an off-ramp, saying that the war could be over in about 2 to 3 weeks' time. Come that 3 weeks' time and we say that the war is over, what happens? Does everything go back to normal?
The first challenge is whether Donald Trump actually has an off-ramp. He was in control of starting this war, but he is not in control of finishing. it. The Iranians have a big say in when the war ends. So America may declare the end of military operations. That doesn't mean the Iranians will do the same. If we think in terms of instability across the Straits of Hormuz and the Arab Gulf states going forward, one Iranian drone a week or even a month creates instability. So the US ending the conflict doesn't necessarily end the conflict. I think that's very important context for what's going to happen next. Now, let's say, best case scenario, 3 weeks' time, the war ends, the Strait of Hormuz reopens, shipping starts to move along the straits. We all breathe a huge sigh of relief knowing our oil and our fertilizer is on the way. We still have the disruption that's built up over the last 4 weeks of war. Now, that's hit oil prices instantly and LNG prices because it is a global market, but we will have the trickle-on effects probably for another 3 to 4 months after hostilities end. At a lower order of magnitude than if this carries on for another 12 months, but we will continue to feel it.
We will continue to feel it. Rather, what's the worst case scenario? How bad could it get for South Africans if the direction goes the other way and there's no off-ramp? Global tensions escalate.
Well, South Africa has gone into this situation in a strong position. You know, the economy improved last year. The government of national unity is performing very well. South Africa hosted a very successful G20 last year. The country is now off the FATF's, grey list for not having strong enough, anti-money laundering processes in place. You know, inflation was at 3% going in. You know, we're lucky it wasn't at 10%. Interest rates are 6.5%. So just to provide context, the country was in good financial shape, so it does have a buffer to deal with this. The challenge is if oil prices remain elevated throughout the year and food prices rise on the back of lack of fertilizers, if we have a lower crop production globally this year, prices rise, then that starts to hit South Africans very hard, particularly those on the lowest income. And the challenge for governments, not just in South Africa, is everywhere, is how do they absorb some of that cost without taking on huge debt to the budget, which going into next year then undermines the financial stability of the country. Now, the government has announced, I believe, a R3 discount on fuel levies because obviously petrol prices have gone up today on the 1st of April. So it's taking steps to shield South Africans from some of this impact.
You mentioned the sentiment that has been driven and the work that has been done in terms of structural reforms in the country being removed from the grey list, etc. When we take a look at the sentiment between Washington and Pretoria, the president of South Africa being removed from that invitation to attend the G7 summit in France, what should that tell us? And what sort of an indication does it send to you, at least? Or should it give us some sense of comfort, rather, that even the European allies are saying, well, we're not really taking part in this? And in responding to that, Donald Trump simply saying, well, you'll open the Strait of Hormuz yourselves if we then pull out in about 2 to 3 weeks.
US relations with every country in the world, perhaps with the exception of Israel, are in a very different position to how they were 18 months ago. So South Africa should take comfort from that. Guest lists for every event are changing with Donald Trump in the White House. And he's a very unpredictable president. So a country that can be off a guest list now might find itself his best friend in 6 months' time. There is no international order now. The rules of the game are changing. Trump has very strained relations, as you've said, with European allies as well. And while many European leaders are saying, well, this isn't their war, it becomes our war for everyone in the world because this war is it impacting our access to resources and the cost of those resources. So it's impacting all our economies. So when Trump says, well, Europe can reopen the Straits of Hormuz, I don't envisage a situation where America leaves the Gulf with the strait closed. The Arab Gulf states wouldn't permit that. But America is almost self-sufficient in oil production. It has a far bigger buffer than South Africa does or its European allies. But we know Trump likes to make these grand statements and then walk back from them as circumstances change.
Is that about tacos? So let's take a look at this finally. Which global hotspots should we really be paying attention to right now? And why do they matter for us here at home?
Well, the big one, obviously, is the Iran war. Yeah. And that matters because of the impact it has on inputs to daily lives and manufacturing. So it's inflationary pressure from that war. Now, that comes on the back of the Russia-Ukraine war. And I know we can say, oh, that's a European war. Does it matter to the African continent? It does matter because that created disruption to fuel supplies and fertilizers, which has impact on food supplies. Yeah. So we had that going on, and then Iran is compounding all those weaknesses in the system. We should also be looking at how heavily the Houthis in Yemen become involved in this conflict. Mm-hmm. They have been very restrained so far. They want to maintain peace negotiations with Saudi Arabia, but they have now launched some missiles at Israel. If they close the Red Sea with drone attacks, that will create another choke point at a time when the Straits of Hormuz is closed. That will have a very negative impact on commodity prices, and that will impact South Africans. So I would be focusing on that area for now.
Thank you so much, Doc, for your contribution. Dr. Elizabeth Stevens is Director of Geopolitical Risk Advisory.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A recent report by Stats SA and UNICEF titled Child Poverty in South Africa, Assessing Changes in Multidimensional Poverty, examines trends in multidimensional child poverty based on data from the 2014-2015 Living Conditions Survey and the 2022-23 Income and Expenditure Survey. The report presents both encouraging developments in areas where improvements have been sluggish. It assesses deprivation among children aged 0 to 17 years and further analyzes poverty separately for children aged 0 to 4, 5 to 12, and 13 to 17 years old. Soli Mulai is the Acting Deputy Director General for Population and Social Statistics at SASSA. He joins us now for more on the report. Thank you very much, sir, for your time. Maybe let's start with definitions. Multidimensional child poverty, what does that mean?
Thank you so much, Dudu. To make it simple for the listeners, multidimensional, we are looking at different factors that are affecting the young ones, which is 0 to 17, in terms of the poverty. In the previous report that we have released last year, we were looking at the money matrix, meaning we were looking at the income of the household and able to determine the level of poverty in terms of the poverty line. But then this time around, we are using seven indicators or dimensions that actually give us a sense of poverty, because poverty is a quite complex phenomenon to measure. So we're using different measures to measure poverty.
How is it complex to measure?
It is complex because there's no one unique measure to measure poverty. So hence we are using multiple measures to understand poverty. For example, okay, we're using money matrix in terms of the income. Then we're using dimensional, multidimensional poverty measure to measure poverty. But there's also another measure, which we call it subjective poverty measure, where a respondent will subjectively tell us whether how poor they are. So there's different measures that we're using in South Africa to measure poverty.
Got you. The latest report shows that more than half of South African children are still experiencing multidimensional poverty. Why has progress been so slow over the past decade?
So our report is showing that actually there's a slightly, in terms of the improvement between the two data points that we are actually reporting on. And that percentage, in terms of percentage, we're talking about 3.5 percentage point improvement. But again, this improvement is between the 8-year period. And so you could see that is a quite slow improvement. But however, it is an improvement that we're seeing. Most of the things that we're picking up from the report is that some of the dimension, especially depending on the age group that you are more interested in. If you look at those who are between 5 and 12, we're seeing that there are dimensions in terms of education, in terms of health, and also in terms of the housing, which is including your sanitation, water, and electricity. Those are the dominant dimension or the drivers of multidimensions for those particular age group. And this has been consistent throughout the two data points, or throughout the 8 years period that we are covering. So what it says to us is that the issues of service delivery become key drivers of multidimensional for the young ones, including the education, which in education we're talking about the schools in which they are attending and whether they're attending the school, the distance between where they are staying and where the school is.
What of the geographic location of deprived children? Which provinces recorded the highest deprivation levels?
In terms of the geographical location, firstly, we're starting to see that those who are in our so-called rural areas, they have a higher poverty rate, if you may call it that way, compared to those who are in the urban areas. And we're seeing that your provinces like your Limpopo, your Mpumalanga, they have a quite a high poverty rates, which also, again, it also shows when you're overlaying with the other surveys that we are also conducting, like your service delivery, those areas, areas like Limpopo and Eastern Cape and Mpumalanga, when coming to issues of sanitation and water, those are still some challenges that we're picking up from those particular services. So it's not surprising now from the child poverty report that we are starting to see that Limpopo Africa has the highest rate of child poverty, sitting about 73.7%, although it's down from the 82.4% in 2015. Eastern Cape followed, as I say. Gauteng and Western Cape, those are the two provinces that had the lowest rate. And again, these are the two economic hubs that we know that are the way our most of our economy is happening between within those two provinces.
You'll guide me in terms of this question and your ability to answer, but based on the data, what are the biggest risks if these levels of child poverty persist, and what should policymakers prioritize to turn this around?
I think from our side, because we are not in the policy space, one of the things that we do from the measurement side is that we make sure that we provide the policymakers with all the tools that they need for them to actually evaluate the poverty programs and policies that are in place. The second thing is that we know that the SDG, which is coming to an end in 2038, is indicating to us that by 2030 we need to halve the poverty, especially for the young ones, by half. So this report is also showing that what we have, that the rates that we had in 2015, we only improved them by 3.5%. So with the remaining years, it means that there's more work needs to be done in terms of how we can actually reduce the poverty. And the report is actually giving us some drivers to say, these are the key drivers that if we can able to push the policies and program within with the guidance of these drivers, we are more likely to see some improvement in terms of these indicators.
Fair enough. We've also got a very rural and urban population in South Africa. Is this something that you looked at, and what did the data present?
Indeed, yes. As you pointed correctly, South Africa, we have areas where we classify them as poor, I mean, as rural, and those who are classifying them as urban. And indeed, if you look at it, so-called your urban areas, this is where you find most of the metros. And if you look at the metros, they don't even behave the same. Metros, you find metros similar, Western Cape and your city of Cape Town and city of Johannesburg, and including the city of Tshwane. Those are the ones that we are seeing that over the two data point, they've declined by about 9.4 percentage point. Compared to the other metros like Buffalo City, Mangaung, and Nelson Mandela Bay, those three, when you compare between the two data points, there's some slightly increase in terms of the poverty rate. And then if you look at the other districts that are not metros, where mostly that's where now you find your rural areas, that's where now we're seeing that in actual fact, there is an increase in terms of the poverty rate for the young ones.
Solly, sir, thank you very much for your contribution. Solly Mulai is Acting DDG for Population and Social Statistics at Stats SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's water disruptions are starting to mirror the economic impact of load shedding, with outages affecting businesses, households and productivity across the country. More than half of households have experienced interruptions, some lasting days or even weeks, as aging infrastructure and system failures take their toll. So what does this growing water crisis mean for the economy, and how serious is the risk? Well, Thanda Nanimbele is executive for actuarial risk at PPS Short Term Insurance. He joins us now to take a look at this. Thank you very much, sir, for your time. From a risk management perspective, what is your assessment?
I think what we're seeing now, Dudu, is very akin to what we saw with load shedding in the beginning, where it was almost a nuisance sort of prevalence, and then all of a sudden and very quickly it became quite a big impact on many sectors, and some might even say existential threats in some other sectors as well. And it's just something that we want the country to keep a finger on, and just realize that this can become a lot bigger if we don't actually take proper risk management, look at it and see how we can mitigate the effect of all these water disruptions.
Why is this important, especially when you speak of risk management, right? What are the implications of us not having our finger on the pulse?
I think we don't want a situation where we are beyond a point of being able to reduce the really destructive impact of water shortages. So what's the old saying? A stitch in time saves nine. So it's that sort of thing. Is we need to understand what the risks could be, what the risks are, and how bad this could be, and then start putting things in place and fixing those things we can, so that it doesn't get to that point. If you can think of load shedding in terms of grid failure, great thing, we never got to that, but we don't want that situation where it's outages that are wide out and the impact is wider than, say, certain small locations and places where we can actually go in and fix things and change things.
You spoke of mitigation. Is it obvious to you what needs to be done? It is not unusual to walk in Johannesburg at least, and in the middle of the road, there's just a puddle of water. It might be fun for a 5-year-old, but a 50-year-old knows the consequences of this, right? And so when you speak of mitigation, is it clear to you what needs to be done?
There are a number of things. There's a side of maintenance that needs to happen, which, of course, we can't put on consumers. But one of the ways that we can do as members of society, I guess, is report those leaks as soon as we see them, report them as early as possible, and make sure that those are fixed. Even leaks in our own homes, that those things are fixed, and then we don't lose water unnecessarily. I think that's the one thing. But then secondly, in terms of at home and these things are getting fixed as maintenance is happening. One of the things that we've seen, and we make this example around load shedding as well, is backups, like solar backups. Homes and businesses can start looking at having some sort of water storages at home. And if they're fortunate enough, maybe some boreholes in some areas. Mm-hmm. This could be wider than just a home, but a whole business unit, a whole business block. And then just making sure that, obviously, as we put these things in, that they are put in by professionals, and should anything happen to them, make sure that they're insured properly as well.
There's a figure that is being bandied about. So estimates suggest that South Africa faces a backlog of roughly 400 billion rand to repair and upgrade municipal water infrastructure. What does this tell you?
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. It means it's been happening over time. But look, I believe in what South Africans can do and what South Africa can do. If we think about the 400 billion rand, it's a lot of money. But if we also look at the budgets that municipalities have, and this is spread out across the country, so it's not 400 billion in any one municipality, it's spread across the country. It's obviously not a one-year fix or even a two-year fix, but consistent investment in this infrastructure, maintenance, and in some cases upgrades, we might realize that 400 billion backlog, we could actually make a proper dent in it within the next 3 to 5 years. But it does require some focus and some serious attention.
Where does insurance come in this conversation, more so for businesses?
So the way insurance works is, I mean, it covers sudden instances of, say, burst water pipes, that sort of thing. So it wouldn't necessarily come in from a supply not being made available by a municipality, gradual supply depreciation sort of thing. But what businesses can do is look around their business interruption, because that's what these sort of things do happen. And they can also look at any assets that are water dependent or would be affected by a major pipe burst and those sort of things, or a major shock to supply being restored. And maybe I'll make an example around power surges. When power is restored and there's a power surge and some people's TVs might blow a fuse, similar to that when water is restored, if there are any deep water dependent assets like boilers and that sort of thing that may be affected. Businesses can look at making sure that those things are covered, and business interruption as well, that may be from any issues, is fully understood in terms of what it covers and how it would assist the business in getting back on its feet.
Tandanani, sir, thank you for your time. Tandanani Mbele is Executive for Actuarial and Risk at PPS Short Term Insurance.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The value of South Africa's top 100 brands increased by 12% in 2026. Now, this growth comes as the country moves from a period of stabilization into a more sustained recovery phase. That's according to the Brand Finance South Africa 100 2026 report. Jeremy Sampson is chairman of Brand Finance Africa and joins us for more. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for your time this afternoon. Maybe let's start with some context of how and why this report is put together.
Hi, Dudu. Good to be with you. Basically, Brand Finance is London-based, 25 offices around the world. I've been doing it for 30 years and looks at brands by their financial value and their emotional value, their strength. Both of those rankings are based on international standards. So this is global best practice. So really, we've got global best practice coming to South Africa, and we produce probably about 100 rankings around the world every year, and we look at country rankings and their brands, and we look at sectors like mining or whatever, which will be out in a few days' time. So that way we're comparing South Africa almost with the rest of the world.
Got you. These words, brand value and brand strength, which you have alluded to, they're mentioned quite a lot in the report. So maybe let's deal with some definitions. Brand value, you say it's financial. Brand strength, emotional. Is that how we should understand it?
That's roughly it, yes, because, you know, the financial side, obviously, one goes back, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years. One has the projections 3 or 4 years, although often a company's projections are a little bit on the bullish side, we find. But that way we get a fix on the financial, and that's often, you know, the value of the brand going forward to a client. The emotional side, the brand strength side, is more the reputation. We have about 75 metrics that we use. And as I say, this is a global scorecard where we look at market share, we look at trends, lots of research and data points so that we can see what's going on within a sector as well.
Checkers, maybe let's get into some of the brands that have really captured South Africans. Checkers retains its position as the country's strongest brand in 2026. Talk us through that.
Well, I think any of us has been very aware of the retail wars that are going on the last few years. I think during COVID, suddenly we had an explosion of home deliveries, and you know, some retailers were very quickly to the mark, and Checkers was probably leading the crowd. Others were a little bit slow to the market. And Checkers has been on an incredible roll. And what, COVID started 6 years ago, and Checkers really has been taking advantage of that, and they're following the tailwinds, as it were, and growing all the time. You only have to look at their share of market. You look at the value of their shares on the market. But it is interesting that Checkers also, of course, is part of ShopRite. And between the two of them, they have huge value. You know, the two brands together are over 50 billion rands. And you know, we know that ShopRite perhaps is stronger down in the Western Cape or other areas, perhaps, if we can say, more the bottom end of the market, whereas Checkers is the slightly higher end of the market and in wealthier areas. So between the two of them, they're doing incredibly well and have incredible loyalty. And we're seeing that others are beginning to suffer. You know, Spar is having a very difficult time at the moment, as is Pick n Pay.
Absolutely. But interestingly, Clicks and Pick n Pay rank second and third. So Pick n Pay being third when it comes to brand strength.
And I think Pick n Pay is very interesting because it has such a rich heritage from the Ackermans. But I think most people will realize in the last couple of years it's lost its way a little bit. But there's still huge strength and equity, as you say. I think Sean Summers is now turning that back around. And obviously, they're keeping a very high profile, their sponsorship of the Springboks. And I notice a lot of television advertising as well. So they're fighting back strongly. But they've got a residue of the past. You know, things, as we know, don't get built instantly. They take time to build. And this is where I think Pick n Pay has a lot of goodwill.
And then we take a look at the most valuable brands, MTN retaining that number one position. Interestingly, the remainder of them being dominated by the banking sector.
You're absolutely right. And you know, this is where, 10, 15 years ago, we talk about the big four banks. Now you could almost talk about the big 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, because there are a lot of banks there. And the banking sector is the one in rudest health, if I can put it that way. The brand value year on year of the banking sector is up nearly 18%, which is really huge. And you'll see Capitec, you know, has crept into the top 10 as well. But it's very, very, competitive there. But we have a very, very strong banking sector, and that's good for the customer as well.
Absolutely. Then you've got brands to watch, right? So PEP has emerged as South Africa's fastest growing brand.
Well, I remember when PEP was launched, which was back in the mid-80s. I think it was Renier van Rooyen. And you know, people don't think perhaps that PEP is that old, back to the mid-80s. And they've been sitting there and ticking along very nicely, especially in the Western Cape area. But they've been really turbocharged the last 2 or 3 years. One of the areas, I think, as well, which is very interesting, we should mention, is retailing and banking almost converging in some ways. Mm. And that's where PEP is now offering financial services, as a lot of the other retailers are, or else they're hooking up with each other to help each other as well. Yeah. But PEP is a fantastic success story. The brand has really come to life.
Here's a brand that's also quite a success story for me, at least, Valterra Platinum, because they feature as under the five new brands that are debuting in the ranking. So they include the JSC, Oro, Savannah, Sanral, and you've also got Valterra Platinum there.
Valterra is interesting because, of course, it's only been around, a year or not much more, from Anglo-American platinum. And also it's riding the wave of platinum. You know, when you actually look at what's going on in the world, the price of minerals, gold especially, and platinum. So they're riding that wave. I think the million-dollar question is, we'll be able to keep that going because that's going to be very interesting to see. But an incredible success, and they've really hit the ground running very hard.
They have. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for your contribution this afternoon. Jeremy Sampson is chairman of Brand Finance Africa. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you very much for making us part of your day. Jeremy Maggs is back with you tomorrow. My name is Duduzile Ramela Bagaitsho Pulekio.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.